Okay. So I'm going to be talking about work that's in two papers, and I'll focus mostly on the first paper, which was done in collaboration with Tibor Rakowski, who's a really bright graduate student in Munich, Frank Pollman, who probably most of you know, and Shivaji Sondhi at Princeton. I'll also briefly touch on some work done in a second paper, which was done with Tibor and Frank. Okay, good. And I'm at the University of Birmingham. You already know that. So purpose of this work is to better quantify how quantum mechanical information spreads in ergodic spin chains. I say ergodic there because, depending on the Hamiltonian of the system that you're looking at, quantum information might spread slowly or quickly. So for instance, in many-body localized systems, quantum information spreads logarithmically slowly, whereas in ergodic systems, we expect it to spread ballistically. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself there because I haven't even told you what it means for what I even mean by spread of quantum information. So I'll attempt to be a little bit more precise about that in the next few slides. Okay, so first it's helpful for us to set up a bit of notation. Today, almost exclusively, I'll be talking about one-dimensional systems for simplicity. In fact, many of the results will hold in one form or another for high-dimensional systems, but it makes it a little bit simpler to talk about 1D systems. The setup is we're going to have a spin chain. So that's the Hilbert space is a collection of these local two-dimensional Hilbert spaces, all tensored together. Occasionally, I will lapse into thinking about this Hilbert space as being a q-dimensional Hilbert space. It turns out that many of the results that we can derive exactly are almost equally easy to derive for c to the q instead of Pauli matrices. So I'll occasionally shift between these two things. If you're uncomfortable with this larger Hilbert space, just imagine that we're working with Pauli operators on a spin half chain. So of course you can choose a basis for on-site operators. For instance, in this simpler case where we're just dealing with spin halves, a convenient orthogonal basis for such operators are precisely the Pauli operators and the identity operator. It'll also be necessary today to talk about strings of operators. So more complicated operators, which are tensor products of spin operators on different sites of the system. And here I'll use this notation. It's a bit of an abusive notation. So when I write something like sigma mu, you should think of that as being a tensor product of lots of different Pauli operators on different sites. And this mu on the left-hand side of the equation is really a list of the Pauli operators that you get on the right-hand side of the system, according to this. Does anyone not understand that notation? Because I'll be using it throughout. If you want me to explain that, I'm more than happy to do that. Is everyone okay with that? Okay. Anyway, this is a complete basis for all of the operators that you can get on the Hilbert space for the spin chain. I'll also sometimes use the nomenclature. I'll talk about the support of a Pauli operator, the support of a string. And the support of a Pauli operator are precisely those sites for which the Pauli operator is not equal to the identity. Okay? So, for instance, the Pauli string, sigma x on site 1, tensor identity on site 2, tensor sigma y on site 3, has support on sites 1 and 3, but no support on site 2. That's what I mean by support. Okay, so that's the notation. So now I can be a little bit more precise by what I mean by spread of quantum information. What we're going to do is imagine that we have some Hamiltonian, some local Hamiltonian. It might depend on time, it might not. I'm leaving it quite general at this stage. But we will require it to be local. And what we're going to look at is the following operator equation. We're going to imagine picking some local operator, like the spin on the 47th site, or whatever you want. And we're going to imagine evolving it with this unitary. And of course, when we evolve an operator with a unitary, it just becomes another operator, which can, of course, be expressed as a superposition of some basis for the space of operators. And that's what this notation is. Sorry, this should be a sigma. Okay. So all I'm doing here is expanding this time-evolved operator in terms of simpler tensor products of on-site Pauli operators. So for instance, you know, you might imagine that if you had a spin on site one and you evolved it for a little bit of time t, it would become some linear combination of the spin on site one, x2, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That is all this equation is expressing. So what we're going to do today is talk a little bit about what the structure of these C operators are. And I'd like to convince you that that has something to do with the spread of quantum information in these systems. And one early indication of that is if you were to, for instance, want to calculate the expectation value of the spin at some time in your system, what this equation tells you is that the information that you need in order to measure the spin at time t is stored in the initial state of the system in some complicated superposition of measurements. So that's what I mean here is that the information contained in all of these Pauli strings on the initial state has some influence on this particular operator at a later time. So in order to quantify the spreading of information, I'll focus on how these C mu coefficients depend on time and on the support of this Pauli string mu. And I'll note at this early stage, because it'll play a crucial role later, that these C mu operators have a sort of conservation law that's associated with the following equation. If you have a unitary time evolution, and you imagine taking the trace of your Pauli operator, the modulus of your Pauli operator, this ends up being precisely one. It's easy to see that if you're evolving this with a unitary matrix, that this equation has to be true. Does anyone not see why that's true? It's okay if you don't. So it's important that you understand why it's true. No one? Okay. No one cares, which is all the same to me. Okay, good. So if you express this equation in terms of the original C mu's, what you find is that it's also equal to the sum of all of these weights. And so this gives us a kind of sum rule on the total sum of the moduli squared of these operator spread coefficients. So there's kind of a conservation law associated with the total weight of this of an operator on this basis. And it's a little bit like the norm of a wave function, what's exactly like the norm of a wave function being preserved under time evolution, unitary time evolution. Okay, so I can now be a bit more verbose in expressing what the goals of today's talk are. So I'm going to break this question down into three maybe slightly easier to answer questions, which is I'm going to try and quantify what the sort of average behavior of these C mu t's are as a function of the support of mu and t. And I'm going to try and express more familiar measures of ergodicity or of ergodic behavior in terms of these C mu's. And it will turn out that we can, in a kind of unified language, talk about what entanglement growth means and what scrambling means. I'll explain what scrambling means in a second, in terms of these C mu's. But of course, in general, for a general interacting spin chain, it's incredibly difficult to find out what these CMU-T operators are. If you could do that, you would be able to exactly describe the dynamics of a strongly interacting system. So the general question is probably too difficult to answer. So what we'll try and do is answer an exactly solvable question. The way that we make, the way that we get an exactly solvable question out of this is that we will consider systems that evolve with random local circuits. And it turns out that if we average results to do with these CMUs over choices of those random local circuits, we can get exactly solvable answers. And then it behooves us to check that in more familiar, strongly interacting spin chains that our results continue to hold. And I'll indeed show you some numerical evidence that our central results hold not only in random circuits, but in more general, strongly interacting ergodic spin chains. Okay, good. So let me tell you what the random circuit model looks like. The nice figures in this talk are courtesy of Tibor, so I will not take credit for that. So this is what a random circuit looks like. This is the Hilbert space and some state, and you're acting on it with a collection of nearest neighbor two-site gates. Each one of these two-site gates is HAR-random and independent. That's what the different colors mean. So this is the setup in a random unitary circuit. Each of these unitaries has a dimension Q squared by Q squared, because each of these sites has dimension has Hilbert space dimension Q. So you know that if you act on a Hilbert space dimension D, the space of unitary operators has dimension D squared. So that's where the Q squared by Q squared formula comes from. Let me notice another thing about the circuit. Of course, it's local insofar as I specified that the unitary circuits only involved couplings between nearest neighbor sites. One thing that you can show is that this such a circuit has a kind of exact light cone, which is to say that information here can propagate, has to propagate within these sort of red lines. And with the normalization that I've used for space and time, this red line here corresponds to, let's say, a velocity of 1. Okay, and I'll normalize all of my velocities in terms of this VLC, which V light cone, which is equal to 1. Okay, so let me just tell you the recipe for how we use the HAR randomness to get exact results from this. So what we'll do is we'll express some quantity of interest. It'll either be a coefficient or some moment of the coefficient, or maybe even an entropy or an OTOC. And what we do is we express that quantity in terms of the whole circuit. And then what we can do is HAR average over each individual element of that circuit. And it turns out that HAR average can often be exactly evaluated in these systems. Okay, so let me just list some results. I'm not going to take you through all of the HAR identities that you need to evaluate these. I think I'm just going to summarize what those results are. One thing we find is that if you just HAR average an individual C mu coefficient for, let's say, a Pauli matrix sigma z, you'll find that it's 0. If you, this is kind of just a technical result, if you HAR average a moment of these two things, you find that the HAR averages tend to be diagonal. And indeed, for the individual C mu coefficients, we can write down an exact expression for this HAR average for any Pauli string mu. And it ends up being quite complicated, but we can do that. But it turns out that, you know, these individual C mu coefficients and these moments for these individual C mu coefficients, they're really fine-grained measurements of information spread. By fine-grain, I mean that if you compare the HAR average results to the results that you would get in a more general spin chain, you find quite large deviations from this average behavior. So what we find then is that it's actually rather better to consider expressions which involve sums of many of these operator spread coefficients. And by kind of coarse graining the information, we get quantities which are more and more universal and which we expect to carry over into the non-random setting, carry over better into the non-random setting.
How are they different?
I'll show you an expression for one of them, and you'll see shortly. Okay, so in fact, the following quantity we find is a very useful quantity, which has a behavior in the random circuit model, which appears to carry over really well into the non-random circuit model. So here is such an expression. We call it rho r, and I'll refer to that as the density of right endpoints of operators. So you start out with your didn't intend to do that. You start out with your, let's say, sigma z operator on some site. You evolve it with a random circuit. You'll find that it becomes a superposition of operators within some light cone. And what this rho r measures is the total weight on operators with right endpoint at a particular position s. Okay. So it asks roughly what proportion of the operators in this expression for sigma zt have right endpoint precisely at s. Okay. So anyway, that's what this expression means. One useful thing to note about this expression is that it behaves rather like a conserved density. Well, it is a conserved density, in that if you sum this over the position variable s, you get precisely one. So this quantity is beginning to look like the kinds of densities that conserved densities that we're used to dealing with in, for instance, hydrodynamics. Okay, don't look at this slide because I've made it unnecessarily complicated. I'm going to explain how, when you HAR average this quantity, how this quantity behaves when you perform HAR averaging, and how you expect this quantity to evolve under time evolution. I'll do that on the board. So underlying the explanation I'll give now is that there's actually like an exact, a precise calculation where there's no room for ambiguity. All I will do here is just give you an intuition as to why, as to how this evolves, and then I'll write down an exact equation. Okay, so let's consider some Pauli string.
Sorry, just for a little bit of intuition. I must be making a mistake here. You know, I'm thinking that if you're having random unitaries, almost every single person or every single take a selection from the circuit ensemble will have just a little bit of weight on the farthest possible place you can be all the way to the end cut.
Yep.
Is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
So we're just asking, what is the weight out there?
Well, we're asking.
It's a small subset where it's exactly zero. So maybe measure zero.
Yeah. So for instance, so here's our initial operator, and it's evolved to some string that's supported exactly on this light cone. Well, supported on this within this light cone. If I looked at row R over here, it would be zero, because there are precisely no operators with right endpoints here. Similarly, if I look at row R here, it'll be zero. Okay. And then what we will find is that if you look at row R as a function of position, it has a bump at a particular position on this light cone, and I'll show that shortly. Okay. All right. Good. So. So let's consider some Pauli string, sigma mu, and for illustrative purposes, I'll write down a particular one. That's not a Pauli string. Okay, this goes on somewhere to the left, and its right endpoint is here. It's just identity operators from here onwards. And let's consider acting on this Pauli string, conjugating it by some unitary on these two sites. So when you conjugate this this Pauli operator with that unitary, it essentially becomes a random operator acting on this two-side Hilbert space. Okay, so let's consider what all the possible operators acting on that two-side Hilbert space look like. Well, they end up being combinations of Pauli operators that look like this. There's one further constraint, which is that this operator has trace zero. So it turns out that the trace zero Pauli operators of this form, there end up being 4 squared minus 1 of them. So there are 4 possible Pauli operators on each site. So there's 16 possible expressions of this form. And it turns out that all except for one of those have zero trace. Okay, so you can roughly think of this operator. This is kind of like a hand-wavy argument. It's exactly true that it goes to some linear combination of all of these. Okay. So let's now ask whether this operator will have a tendency to occupy both sites or just one site. Okay. So if we count the number of Pauli operators which are just supported on site R, okay. There are 3 of these, okay? Because I can choose x, y, or z on that site. If I consider how many Pauli operators are supported on the right-hand side and may or may not be supported on the left-hand side, i.e. the number of Pauli operators which definitely occupy this site and can be anything here, there are 3 of these and 4 of these, so there are 12 of these. Okay, so there are many more operators which occupy the rightmost site than there are which operators which occupy only the leftmost site. Okay? And so what that tells you is that, you know, if this becomes some unbiased superposition of all possible Pauli operators, the largest proportion of that weight will have that the Pauli operator has moved to the right. Okay? So there's a sort of entropic factor which tells you that these Pauli operators will tend to want to move to the right. Does that make sense? I can go over that slower because this is like the central point. So just stop me if I'm friendly, you know. So. All right, okay.
Why there is an asymmetry here? Why do we care the right direction or left direction? What difference do they have?
Well, it's okay. So there's an asymmetry between. Well, okay. I can only sort of explain what the calculation gives you.
Right, in the sense of calculation.
Yeah.
If you only look at those two sites,
yeah,
what's the difference between two? Why one direction is preferred?
I mean, the operator started on the left, right? There was nothing to the right. So it's much value than.
We're looking at the right endpoint of a particular operator, and we're asking what could possibly happen to that. Yeah, and then we would find that the left endpoint of the operator undergoes bias. We'll tend to want to spread to the left. Basically the moral behind this is that there are many more bigger operators than there are smaller operators. Okay. And we're just examining the edge of this operator. So you know, if this operator just evolves according to where most of the operators are in the space of all operators, it's clear that the operator will want to grow. Want to occupy that whole space, and that's what this calculation is saying.
So that's an entropic.
Precisely. And in fact, the entropic factors end up being rather simpler than you might think. So it's actually deceptively simple. I thought I understood this for like a full few weeks, and then I realized that I had sort of just gotten lucky. So in the more general case where you're dealing with q-dimensional Hilbert space, these numbers become q4 minus 1, q squared minus 1, q squared minus 1. Okay. So it turns out that if you want to understand how this operator density evolves, you can think of the operator right endpoint as undergoing bias diffusion, in that it will hop to the right with a probability p equal to and it will hop to the left with the complementary probability, which is equal to q squared minus 1, q4 minus 1. And notice that these are precisely the factors that we get here. This guy is here.
Sorry, I think I am really confused. If you're talking about a right endpoint, that means a particular choice of mu, a particular choice, right? And then the probability is over random circuits?
Yeah, that's right.
So won't almost all random circuits take you a little bit? I think that's the part that's tripping up. Won't they almost all make your support on the next site slightly non-zero? I'm really missing.
Okay. So I've given you the intuition there. Let me tell you what the exact equation of motion for the density operator ends up being as a result of this. It should be here. Oh, wait, okay, whoops. Right. Sorry, there was meant to be another equation here. So, okay.
Does drift velocity come from the
central? That's right, yeah. Okay. The drift velocity comes from this, yeah, precisely this entropic factor. So let's suppose that I have operator weight. So let's consider site 1 and site 2. And correspondingly, we have a density associated with site 1 and a density associated with site 2. Okay. So what I'm telling you is that if you look at the density on site 1 at time step t plus 1, and see at site 2 t plus 1. Actually, I'm not sure if this is going to be helpful. Sorry. Yeah, all right. I better actually just hurry up. Yeah. So, okay. What that calculation ends up giving you is the following discrete equation for the Haar averaged operator density. Okay? So it tells you that this operator weight will tend to want to move to the right, that operators will tend to want to grow. And so what that entropic argument ends up giving you is this discrete equation up top there. That's exactly true on average. The over bars denote Haar averaging. And I'm telling you that a continuous time and space version of that equation is this. Okay? All right.
So it's basically a biased random walk.
Precisely, yeah. It's precisely a biased random walk, yes. So, I'll give you a picture for that now. Okay, good. So what this picture denotes, so we have some operator here, and it's a color map which tells you, so there's also a density of left-hand endpoints, which is this row L here. What this color map tells you is, it gives you the size of this quantity, root T times rho L times rho R, okay? So what this is telling you, just ignore this left-hand side of the picture, is that the right-hand endpoints will tend to want to grow ballistically, but there will be some spread associated with their growth as well. And what that basically means is that it's true that the operators will tend to want to grow outwards because of those entropic reasons, but it's a quantum mechanical system, so there's always a finite probability amplitude associated with the operator sort of hanging around that site or speeding up. And that ends up leading to this, to what ends up being a diffusive spread, like a square root of t spread. So the operator grows ballistically, but there's a certain amount of fuzziness as to where the right endpoint is. And this is like the central result, because
There's a question. So how important is it that it is Haar random unitaries here?
I'm going to get to some numerics in a second. So, what does your question mean? As in, like, if I chose different...
All these results, you're averaging here over...
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Haar random average.
Yeah, okay, so you're worried that the bias diffusion is... No, no, but it's a fair worry that the bias diffusion is coming from the randomness in the circuits. In fact, we checked as well using TBD on a number of flow case spin chains, and we found that in those cases, there was also good evidence for... bias diffusion, yeah.
Is it also a case for holography?
Holography? I have no idea. Sorry.
So yeah. the two parts of the light cone are both going out at, or you know, the light cone and then the entanglement. They're both.
Forget about this entanglement. I haven't even explained what VE is. Yeah.
I just want to. They're both going at something proportional to t, and the
yes.
width is going like root t.
That's
so
correct.
That will become more and more precise, I guess, like
yes.
fractional.
Yes. Yes. And indeed, that there's a sort of scaling form for what the operator weight looks like along here, and you can show we can show exactly on average that at long times this is in the vicinity of this line is described by just a sort of moving Gaussian wave packet,
yeah.
like ends up being almost exactly bias diffusion. So, so this is like a central result, and maybe it seems like quite obscure because I'm talking about how operator spread coefficients work, and those might not be things that you think are particularly interesting. But it turns out that this biased diffusion behavior can be used to explain what happens to out-of-time ordered correlations in systems like these, and also how entanglement grows in systems like these. So we'll be able to derive exact results on entanglement growth and OTOX in terms of this result. And this bias diffusion will be central to how those quantities behave. Okay, I should have preempted Ergenell's point. Sorry, your first name, Martin Ergenell? So obviously this is a crucial result. It'll underpin all of our further results. So at this point, I just want to sort of pause and present some numerical evidence that indeed you got something that looks like bias diffusion in deterministic ergodic spin chains. So the model that I'm looking at here is a driven Ising spin chain. So this is the Floquet unitary associated with a time periodic Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian has no local conserved quantities, It doesn't even have a because it comes from a time evolving Hamiltonian, it doesn't even have a conserved energy, okay? Also, there's no randomness. I'm not averaging over any particular, I'm not averaging over any sort of random quantity within that Hamiltonian. So it's some two-part drive. In the first part of the period, you have one Hamiltonian, which looks like ZZ plus Z. In the second part of that drive, you have another Hamiltonian, which looks like X, okay? And it turns out that people have looked at this model in a number of other contexts, and there are certain values of parameters in this model which thermalize very quickly, and we ended up looking at those. We looked at a variety of them and didn't see any much, all that much difference in the results. In this figure, I believe we used t equals 0.8 and h equals 0.89. So let's maybe just concentrate on this right-hand figure. So what this right-hand figure does is it looks at the, you look at the average position of the of right endpoints in your operator, which is this guy over here within this bracket, and you look at the variance in that position, okay? And so if you have a diffusive broadening of a front, you should find that this guy ends up scaling like root t. And indeed, we find a reasonably good fit to root t spreading. Of the wave packet. So there's good evidence that the operator front diffusively broadens in this case.
So you're literally plotting the part.
Yeah, we're literally plotting that. This comes from like TBD numerics for operator spreading. You can see that so in the previous picture, you know, these ended up looking like Gaussian wave packets at different positions. You can see that they have some other features at least at small times, but at least it is still true that the average position the variance in this position goes like square root of t. So we have some evidence for this. We don't really have a deeper analytic argument for it, and I think that that's an interesting question that we're trying to address now. Okay, so summary so far is that in these random circuit models, at least we can show that operators grow behind this diffusively broadening, ballistically growing front. Diffusively broadening ballistic front. It broadens diffusively like a square root of t. And we've also, for a number of models, confirmed that this diffusive broadening is present without randomness, without having to average over randomness. Okay, so now I'll try to relate some of these diffusive broadening properties to derive some of the behavior of outer time order correlators and entanglement growth. And it's kind of useful to do this because it will show you...
How does the sigma, if you would only look at sigma, did you look also at like local operators that don't have strings? Do they have similar? Like if you would only look at sigma z, for example? Have the same?
I don't understand. Sorry. Oh, right. So you're asking if I look at the total weight on.
I'm putting like a sigma z only instead of the string, measuring a sigma z.
Wait, sorry. So you want to look at c mu?
No,
where?
That's zero. Okay.
All right. I didn't understand the question, but I'll still draw on. Okay, good. So out of time order correlators, I'm awful at motivating these, and I think that shows that there's a lot I still don't understand about this part of the field. Often given motivation for this is you, within classical dynamical systems, chaos is something like a sensitive dependence on initial conditions. And one measurement of this is you could look at some classical phase space with coordinates PQ, and you could ask, you know, how sensitive is the phase space trajectory to the initial value of one of those phase space coordinates? And you can express this in terms of a Poisson bracket, and we associate classical chaos with some exponential growth in this in the early times for this Poisson bracket. So then, of course, it's been a question for many years in quantum mechanics whether there's a sort of quantum analog of chaos, and there's a obvious thing to look at in this case, which is the quantum mechanical generalization of Poisson bracket. We can ask how this object behaves, where this is some sort of thermal average. So I won't give much more motivation than that for studying the quantity. I'll just tell you how it behaves. Suffice it to say, it's obviously of central importance. It seems to be of central importance in a lot of questions in holography and scrambling. but I won't really motivate it further than that. One other thing I'll say is that usually this quantity is defined in the following, and you take this average with respect to a thermal ensemble. That's what this subscript beta means. In the problem we're dealing with today, there are no conserved quantities, there's no conserved energy, so it doesn't really make sense to average it with respect to some Hamiltonian. So what I'll do is I'll set beta equals zero for today. And that corresponds to infinite temperature. Beta equals zero is infinite temperature. So the OTOC that I'll speak about today would probably be called the infinite temperature OTOC in other literature. And this is what it looks like. And for the purposes of today, it doesn't matter really what local operators we use. So I actually may as well just use sigma z. Okay? So that's what I'll mean by OTOC today. Okay, so obviously in this SYK model, we see analogies of this classical chaotic behavior where you have this early time exponential growth, but also in various local quantum field theory models like ON models, weakly coupled fermions, this OTOC has been shown to have at sufficiently early times this exponentially fast growth. In analogy with classical chaos. And then there are a number of results. I don't think any of them are exact in the quantum field theory literature. I believe that all of them not only use a semi-classical approximation, but they also tend to throw away a lot of other diagrams for other reasons. And so it's not... I don't think any... You could say that any of these things are really controlled calculations. But they do nonetheless show that within this set of models, which typically has some large parameter, like a large spin or a large n, you can see early time exponential growth. So we were quite interested to calculate the OTOC in this exactly solvable setting and see what happened. And one interesting thing we found is that we just don't have this extended Lyapunov regime. And we can show that exactly. Yeah.
But if I think about zero-dimensional random circuit, then
yeah,
don't we see some exponential?
Yeah, but I'm distinguishing these quantum field theories, these sort of local quantum field theories from models like that. Yeah.
So all these previous results are for 1D system.
Yeah, so I'll mention some other work by Adam Nahum, and they in one fell swoop did the 1D, 2D, and 3D cases.
How the diffusion?
Yeah, so it goes by, it ends up being determined by, I should say in those cases there's no supporting numerics because we can't really do the numerics in high dimensions. But if you believe that the random circuit picture gives you an accurate description for what should happen, I think, for instance, I might have this wrong, but I think in d equals 2, they get t to the third. Oh. And d equals 4, it can actually depend, it can end up being, d equals 3 can end up being non-universal and depend on some of the geometry in the lattice.
It coincides with the droplet.
Yeah, it's a droplet model, it's like an Eden growth model. Yeah.
So I guess at infinite temperature, the variance, I believe, becomes very small.
At infinite temperature?
No, zero dimensions.
Oh, and zero, yeah.
Like SYK.
So actually, I've not done that calculation. Maybe I can ask you about that later. I should probably hurry a little bit.
Based on 1, 2, and 3 dimensions, it will not be
crazy. Sorry, what's that?
So based on 1, 2, and 3 dimensions, the spread seems to be narrower and narrower.
Oh, okay. Oh, so if you conflate taking a high dimensional example. Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. Good. So let's express the OTOC in terms of these C coefficients. So I've done that for this particular OTOC, and you can see that it's this OTOC between sigma z zero and sigma z s is the total weight on operators which are either sigma x or sigma y on site s. That's what this means. Okay. And that's what the OTOC means in this language. Okay, I'll try to give a little bit more intuition later as we calculate as I present some exact results. So anyway, we've expressed this in terms of C's now, and so we know exactly how those C's behave on average after we har average, and so we do the har average, And what we find is that the Haar average C ends up being related to an integrated density of right endpoints. You can think of this as the total operator weight of operators supported to the left of S. Okay? So all you should take from this is that C is related to this thing which, to an integral of the thing that behaves according to Bayes diffusion. So this actually ends up looking like an error function because it ends up being the integral of a diffusively moving packet. Okay. So now we can, I can show that all on one picture. This is the picture we had before. This is what rho looks like. And C basically looks in this region like an integral. Is related to like 1 minus an integral of this rho function. And the thing that I've plotted there is an exact C. Ends up working like that. So this C sort of ends up having this plateau structure. And the transition from its value of 1 to value of 0 also, that region also grows like square root of t. Okay, so that's what it looks like. Indeed, we can write down an exact expression for this C and look at how it behaves in various regimes. And so the reason we wanted to do this was we wanted to look for a regime in which it's exponentially growing, but we didn't find any such regime. So here is a log linear plot against of the OTOC versus the distance into the light cone. So what we're doing here is we're calculating the OTOC for some sigma z at 0 against sigma z at time t. And we're adjusting this position. So when sigma z at position s is outside of the light cone, the OTOC is 0. As it moves into the light, obviously these two operators will commute if they're not causally connected. And as you move into the light cone, it comes up from 0, and that's what this means. And so this distance is just distance into the light cone. All right. So we end up finding three different regimes here. So there's this early time regime. There's a regime near what we're calling the operator front, where everything's described by error functions and the like. And then there's a late time regime where the OTOC saturates to its value of 1 exponentially quickly in delta. So I'll write down each of those functional forms. So at early times, the OTOC, so it looks something like this. So as you move into the light cone, if you were to ignore this log term, it would be growing exponentially quickly moving into the light cone. But in fact, first of all, if there was a Lyapunov exponent, it appears to depend on the initial separation of the two operators and grow logarithmically with that separation. And then there's also this additional logarithmic correction in delta. So either way, you just can't fit this guy with a fixed Lyapunov exponent. There's a second regime, which is near the front, where, as I was saying, everything is described by error functions. The OTOC looks like this. But again, it's not a regime where there's a fixed Lyapunov exponent. And then right at the end, at very late times, the OTOC saturates to 1 exponentially quickly. Okay. Either way, the thing to take away from this curve is that there's no prolonged linear Lyapunov regime. Also, another thing to note is that the fact that the OTOC is described by this error function it shows that this diffusive broadening behavior is important for physics of the OTOC. Okay, so now in the last bit, I'll just briefly talk about entanglement growth. The setup here is I'll imagine starting with some product state. Unfortunately, I've done this in the most general case where we have a q-dimensional on-site Hilbert space. But if you're having difficulty with that, just imagine that this initial state is a density matrix of this form. Okay. And of course, if you expand this out in terms of the z's, you get a sum over all possible z strings, which is what this notation is. Z strings, sigma nu. Okay, so that's what this notation means. Okay, so the way that we're going to figure out how entanglement is growing. Well, we're not actually going to look at the Verneumann entropy, we'll look at a Reni entropy. So the way that we calculate that Reni entropy is we'll evolve this operator using our Haar random circuits, and then we'll calculate the reduced density matrix. And it turns out that the reduced density matrix, all that does is it will pick out those operators on the right-hand side of this expression at time t, which have support entirely in region A. Okay? And it kills anything that has a non-trivial operator outside of region A. So if you follow that through, you find that the exponentiated second Reni entropy is just the weight of all of those, the total weight from the time evolved right-hand side of this expression, which lies entirely in region A. And that ends up looking like this.
You think of all the possible G operators in
yes.
A and let them evolve and then ask how many of them remain.
Yeah. Sorry, I should have done it here. Yeah. So you look at this expression. Each one of these will have an expansion of its own. Yeah, I should have just done this here. Okay, like this. The reduced density matrix. So you do a trace on this Pauli string. Will just pick out those Pauli strings which have string mu supported in A. Okay, so this is reduced density matrix A. Then this exponentiated Reni entropy, second Reni entropy, is just trace of this guy squared, which ends up just being the total weight on these coefficients. Okay, so that indeed is this expression. But again, we know how to evaluate the right-hand side of this equation under Haar averaging, because it just involves moment of two of these c's. So we do that. So this is the exact expression, but then we can Haar average it. And long story short, after you Haar average it, you get this expression in terms of rows. Okay, and we can exactly evaluate that and determine its asymptotic behavior. And it ends up being quite a fun game of you imagine starting with all of these possible Z strings. So you know there are many possible, and you sort of bunch them together by where their right hand endpoint is. So there are a number of strings that'll have the same right hand endpoint, and you ask how long it takes for this right hand endpoint to diffusively spread past the cut, and that's essentially how this calculation works. And you can do that exactly. And we end up finding that this Haar average exponentiated entropy ends up decreasing like this. And so that means that the second Reni entropy is increasing. And it decreases with this scale that we call VE, which is in the QFT literature called entanglement velocity. I'm not sure I really like that term for it, but that's what people call it. And it ends up being a scale that's a little bit slower than the butterfly velocity. And this is an exact expression for it. And it turns out that you can trace this inequality directly to the diffusive broadening. So if you write down a model for this entanglement growth without the diffusive broadening, you find that these two scales are exactly equal to one another. But the diffusive broadening is responsible for this disparity. OK, then you might ask, OK, so we've calculated this exponential average of the Reni entropy. What is the average behavior of the Reni entropy itself? You know, you might worry that there's a difference between these two expressions because logging and taking a Haar average don't necessarily commute. But we check this numerically, and in fact they agree really, really well. So there's no funny business happening in going between those. So we can really identify this quantity with the average Reni entropy. There's another figure here which shows that as a function of Q, the entanglement growth curve becomes sharper and sharper. It saturates faster and faster. Okay, so in the last 5 minutes, I'll just use some of what we've spoken about today to distinguish between two two things that we associate with diagnosing ergodicity in systems, and one of those is entanglement growth. So we'd say that in ergodic systems, entanglement grows linearly in a local quantum system. That's kind of one measure of ergodicity. Another thing that you might have associated with ergodicity is OTOC growth. You might think that systems only scramble when they if they're ergodic. Let's just distinguish. We now have an expression for these two things in terms of the same quantity C. So let's try and get some intuition for what these two different quantities mean. So in the entanglement growth case, I'll start on the right. You can see that this expression will tend to decrease provided operators tend to grow, right? Because if operators tend to grow, then as time evolves, more and more operators leave this region A. So there's less and less operator weight within region A. So this expression decreases, and so the second Renyi entropy increases. Okay. That tells you that provided you have a model where operators will in thermodynamic limit, ignoring recurrences and things like this, provided you have a model where operators tend to grow, you expect to see some sort of increase in entropy. On the other hand, this OTOC tends to saturate to its long-time value 1 when there's kind of an equal likelihood, when these C's are somewhat independent of what mu is doing on a particular site. So what I mean by that is that this quantity begins to saturate when to its value of 1 when if you look at all the operators superposed in this time evolved sigma z operator, when they all like have an equal likelihood of being any of the Pauli matrices, that's when this quantity starts to saturate. So we use that to kind of argue that this OTOC is more a measure of equilibration for operators. If you have an operator and it grows, it becomes some complicated superposition of strings, the OTOC is kind of measuring when those strings end up looking random, like random Pauli strings. So it's measuring something that's rather different to what the entanglement is measuring. And indeed, we can come up with a concrete example which illustrates this. So if you, for instance, look at a Clifford circuit, which is a model which takes a Pauli operator to just another Pauli operator. So this is an example of a Clifford circuit. It would take Z to Y and Y to this operator and X to this operator. You find that for an initial product state, this will very quickly, entanglement will grow really quickly in this, linearly in this model. But if you look at the outer time order correlator, you'll find that the outer time order correlator in this model just oscillates from one time state to the next between 0 and 2. So it shows this sort of behavior like this. So it doesn't show this saturation that we associate with OTOCs usually. Sorry, saturation to value 1 we associate with OTOCs. Okay, sorry, maybe I didn't make that point so well. Anyway, okay, fine. So let me just conclude. So the main points from the talk are that spin chains with unitary evolution and without any conserved densities like energy or charge do still have this conservation law associated with preservation of quantum information. And moreover, this a conserved quantity associated with this conservation of information, this information, can flow according to an equation that we are more likely to associate with hydrodynamics. So there's a hidden conserved quantity and there's a kind of hydrodynamics associated with it. And we were able to show that it had to do with bias diffusion. We were able to prove exact results on average in random circuits, and we backed up some of those exact results with numerical simulations. Writing everything in terms of these C's allowed us to say something about the difference between systems which just have entanglement growth as opposed to systems which scramble or which show sort of a non-trivial OTOC behavior. So there are various extensions to this. One of the extensions we had was to actually incorporate a local conserved U1 charge. And so there we chose circuits that were random, except they were forced to individually conserve charge, let's say, conserve some U1 quantity. And in that case, much of the story ends up being the same, but there's a kind of interesting caveat, which is that in systems with a conserved U1 charge, you find that although many operators grow ballistically, there's a subset of operators which have overlap with your conserved charge, which will tend to only grow diffusively quickly. So a lot of operators grow ballistically, but a subset of operators grow slower, like root t. In addition to there being this ballistic front, there's also a diffusive bit that lags behind, and we call that a diffusive tail. And so there are signatures for this diffusive tail both in the OTOX and in the operator weights. But unfortunately, I didn't want to go into that because our analytical understanding of that was a bit less sound. And I just can't solve it exactly.
Sorry?
I can't solve it exactly. Without taking some other sort of large something limit. In our case, it ended up being something like that, yeah. Bit more, yeah, I can maybe, there's a slide and maybe I can explain a bit later. Okay, and maybe I just won't talk about the other one. So this is the paper on which most of today's talk was based. This is a paper by, this is also a related paper by Adam Nahum and Sagar Vijay, Jun Ronha, and Riman. I've forgotten his name. This is our paper which had spreading with symmetry, and there's also a companion paper to that which involved Vedika Kamani, David Hughes, and Ashwin Vishwanath. I've actually missed out a paper that there was a paper which was published on the same, which came out, these are two separate papers. This is one on entanglement growth and KPZ dynamics and entanglement growth, and this is a paper on the diffusive broadening phenomena, which they also looked at. That's all I wanted to talk about.
Because the usual struggle is associated with the exponent associated with temperature, right?
Yeah.
So if you don't have any energy, then you don't have any temperature, so...
Yeah, we have no way of testing the chaos bound in this case.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah.
In general, if you were just at infinite temperature, you wouldn't expect any...
Yeah, it's not useful bound in that, yeah. In that situation, yeah. But that's right, but I think there was still an interesting question as to how this quantity should behave in, like having any exactly solvable result, I think, is useful, especially if that result ends up being at odds with, what you find in the other parts of the literature. Anyway. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Is there
a metric for flow of quantum information based off these C mu coefficients?
For flow, like current.
Can we measure?
Like in an experiment or something.
No. Can we define metric for this flow?
I think you want to define a current operator for this flow.
Conserved.
Sorry?
So this row R... this behaves something like local charge density at time t. Okay. I think what you're asking is you want something that looks like current. Or maybe you're not asking that.
Can we define a current?
Yeah, so in that paper with symmetry, what we do is we define all of the quantities that you saw today as super operators on, you can, and some of the details of this are in the appendix to the second paper. But the trick is to, instead of thinking about problem on the original Hilbert space, you go to an operator Hilbert space, which I'll sort of denote in this way, and you can write this as an expectation value of a particularly simple operator on that operator Hilbert space, and you can similarly define a current in that case. Yeah, it's I'm not sure I'll be able to do it live. Yeah. Yeah.
Might be a silly question, but why did you look at Fouquet dynamics?
No conserved quantities. So if we just looked at a fixed Hamiltonian, there'd be an energy lying around, and we'd in fact expect to see these diffusive tails. Yeah. Oh, actually, I should say Shireen had a senior thesis on looking at, I think, precisely that. Yeah. Case with a fixed Hamiltonian. Yeah. Yeah.
More questions? If not, you're here for another week, right?
Almost two.
Almost two, yeah. So, I'm asking.